I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
How's your feeling, Abby?
We've not started on our burgers yet.
It's excellent, thank you. It's enhanced by this spectacle, which I'm very much enjoying. We're playing really well.
Yeah, we are playing well.
Hello, it's Tuesday, 17th of December. I'm Andy Brassel, she's Jules Breach, and this is Jules and Andy on Football Ramble Daily. This week we'll be speaking about, what else will we be speaking about? We're speaking about the A23 derby of last night between Crystal Palace and Brighton, which had Jules on the very edge of her seat. We'll also be talking later on about declining TV audiences and could this mean any changes for the games? And of course, we'll be digging into your lovely correspondence as we always are. And you can always get at us on at Jules Breach, at Andy Brassel, at Football Ramble, and Jules and Andy at footballrambledaily.com. You know, Jules, at this point, I usually ask you how your weekend's been. The weekend seems a million miles away because last night was what it was all about, wasn't it?
It was. I waited the whole weekend just to get round to Monday night football and watch Crystal Palace Brighton. And, you know, my initial thoughts at the full-time whistle were of disappointment because we dominated the majority of the game and I think deserved the win. But on reflection, now I've had a bit of time to think about it and look back. You know, if when we'd gone into the game, if we knew we would come away from Selhurst Park in the derby with a point, we'd probably have not been, you know, too annoyed about that. But it is just tough when you've dominated the game and you feel like you've deserved to win it, to come away with a draw when we should have been going back home with all 3 points just really is quite frustrating. But, you know, a point at Selhurst Park isn't the worst thing in the world. And to be fair to Palace, they really came back into the game. And Zaha's goal was a brilliant goal. So. Yeah,
and that last 20 minutes, to go from not being anywhere in the game to getting some sort of foothold and making that count quite quickly, because we talked about the goal coming, but it had only really been coming for, what, 5 or 6 minutes, hadn't it? You know, that was when Palace started to put the pressure on and they made it count quite quickly, because, you know, you can't remember really Matt Ryan making a ton of saves or anything like that, can you? From my perspective, it was my first time properly watching Brighton with you, because we watched bits of Brighton games together before.
When we're working, yeah.
Yeah, but normally you're prepping, I'm prepping. When I watched Brighton Tottenham earlier in the season, you just sort of popped your head round the corner at BT and did a quick, oh yay!
3-0!
And then you're off, and yeah. I was mainly sat next to Harry Redknapp going, oh, this is terrible. This is so terrible. Which probably you would have enjoyed even more, and you would have appreciated even more than me. But it was great to get that sort of insight. I've covered Palace Brighton games before, and I know how intensely they're felt. Are you like this for all Brighton's games, or particularly for Palace Brighton?
Excitable.
it's important to be excitable. Why wouldn't you when you're following your own team?
Yeah, there's a lot of swearing when I watch football, isn't there?
Is there?
I love it.
Let's not let them too far behind the curtain. Come on.
Well, Charlie, who's our producer for this, said to me, you know, I'm going to record some bits just so we can use them during the podcast this week, and needless to say, there's not a lot he can use.
3 minutes out of 3 hours.
I do really apologize. I am quite passionate when I watch my team play, and I get really into it, and I think the derby's different. This is the game where when the fixtures come out, it's the first one I look for. You always look for when you're going to play your biggest rivals in the league. And say what you want about this derby. Some people think it's not a real derby. As far as I've been alive, they've been Brighton's biggest rivals. So I don't know any
Palace
different.
Fans would say the same.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, other football fans kind of look down on it like, oh, it's not a proper derby. How's that a derby? Barely, like, you know, Palace are in London and Brighton are down on the south coast. But
explain a little bit to, like, listeners outside the UK who don't get it, why it is a rivalry and why we call it the A23 derby.
Yeah, well, the A23 connects London to Brighton. So in terms of why it's called the A23 derby, that is the road that leads from the south coast right up to London. So that's where it gets that nickname. But in terms of the rivalry, it's one of the weird ones that's really difficult to explain, because it's not a simple, oh, they played each other in a really big game and that's why they hate each other. Like, that's not where the rivalry was born. It actually was born way back in history, in football history, between two managers who basically didn't like each other. And it became the rivalry between the two managers that then developed into the rivalry between the two teams. So it's Terry Venables and Alan Mullery. And they ended up facing each other as managers. And that's kind of where the rivalry began. And then over the years, it's just developed into what it is today, which is they are the two teams that really, in terms of distance, are the closest together. From Brighton to where Crystal Palace is, Selhurst Park, is actually our closest team.
And also, there's the fact that you have the main train line from Brighton, which goes through East Croydon Station.
Yeah.
And Croydon's a hugely Palace area. Yeah. So it's a very, very strongly Palace era. Alan Mullery, actually, I wasn't expecting to get on to him tonight. First player ever to get sent off for England.
Is he really?
Yeah,
how about that?
It's a good fact, isn't it?
Do you know, he's a really nice man. He does a lot of work at the Amex still and for the club in terms of, you know, like media engagement on the day. And he goes into the lounges and does a few talks and stuff. And he's a really, really nice bloke.
So I love how it goes from red card to nice man. People say that about Duncan Ferguson. He's lovely. Great with kids.
Well, he's Mullery's a club legend.
As long as you're not a centre-back, he's a lovely bloke.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, so that's really where the rivalry was born. And then obviously, in terms of the playoffs a few years ago in the Championship to come up to the Premier League, there was
I did the first leg of that, which was quite a dour 0-0 draw at Selhurst. And then Brighton obviously... Palace obviously won the return at the Amex.
Thanks for reminding me. Yeah, and that was Poogate, that game, which we won't go into too much detail on.
Just Google it.
Yeah, Google it. You don't know from me. But yeah, so that's the rivalry, really. And you know, when it comes to the league, last year we did the double over Palace. So coming into this game, the way we were playing, the form we're in, despite the fact that we've not got as many wins this season as I think we should have, I was pretty confident coming into the game, to be fair. I was thinking, you know, I think the way we're playing, and because Palace have got a few injuries in their team and thinking about how they would line up and how we'd line up, I was pretty confident coming into the match. And for the first hour of the game, we completely dominated them. I think first half, they didn't have a single shot. And Neil Maupay's goal, and I have to say, we love it. New player to the club. The way he scored that goal, which was a brilliant finish into the roof of the net. And then the way he celebrated, he gave the Palace fans the shh. Oh, it was brilliant. Loved that.
But it's brilliant as well, I think, for celebrating a goal as an away player at Selhurst Park. It's like when Knockhart scored that fantastic goal there. That if you wheel away, if you score on the right-hand side of the penalty area as you're looking into it as an attacker, it's really easy to go off and celebrate.
Just go past them.
Just go past the ones in the corner and then celebrate with all the away fans in the Arthur Waite stand, which is the big stand on the main broadcast camera side. So basically you have the same view as you have if you're watching it on television, except you normally have a post in front of you and it costs you about 40 quid. It's funny, actually, talking of that. Obviously, I watch a lot of football at Selhurst Park, being a Wimbledon fan. Didn't enjoy most of it because it was never our place. But it does make me think, especially when seeing you get so passionate over Palace versus Brighton, we've not really got a rival at the moment, which is a strange thing. And part of it's because, you know, there was a bit of rivalry between Wimbledon and Palace when we shared a stadium, because we didn't really feel that welcome and they didn't really feel like they wanted us, I suppose. But since then, because I've seen Wimbledon play in how many different divisions? Probably about 8. I mean, because it's such an unusual story, the AFC Wimbledon story as well, that you never hang around long enough to have a rival. Like, I don't know, like the most local club when we were in the Combined Counties League back in 2002 and 2003, 2004 would have been Rains Park Vale, but we always beat them like 5-0 or whatever. Then there was a bit of back and forth with Crawley when we were in the conference, because they were a really moneyed club and because Steve Evans was their manager and he can antagonise simply anyone.
Anyone.
You know, he could start an argument in an empty room. There's no doubt about it. And I think people from outside the club see MK Dons as a rivalry. To me, rivalries are born historically over time rather than with clubs that, you know, didn't even grow organically, really. So
I remember earlier on in the season when they played each other and I said to you, did you watch the game? And you said, no, I refuse to watch when they play MK Dons.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a proper game to me. I don't want to waste my leisure football credits, of which I have relatively few, on a game like that. I'd rather, when I see us play, I don't know, Coventry or Millwall, or you know, sort of big teams that we played in the last couple of years, and especially teams that we played in the Premier League, Luton, whoever else, that makes me feel excited. That makes me feel really, really excited. But this is just, if Wimbledon are playing MK, I just think, oh, it's really unpleasant. And well, you know, what would it prove? I mean, I've spoken about it before and said, you know, if they beat us 5-0. The whole football world still knows we're better than them. Mm-hmm. And if we beat them 5-0, our club still got nicked. It really doesn't make any difference. It doesn't boil down just to one single game. But it's interesting, going back to last night's game and going back to Brighton Palace, it was interesting that the interviews we had in the Flash for Sky afterwards, you had Wilfried Zaha and Neil Maupay, the two goal scorers being interviewed, and they both seemed like totally exhausted by the intensity of it. They both looked as if they were going to nod off during the interview, and especially Zaha, he looked like someone had been pushing a boulder up a hill, which he felt like he had been for a lot of the evening. And it was interesting to hear him say, I thought it fed in quite nicely to what you were saying about how well Brighton have played this season, how different the players under Potter. He just said, well, when we got the ball back, we're too knackered to do anything with it. Like they couldn't get Brighton on the counter-attack because they were just tired from chasing them.
And I think that probably was their game plan coming into this. And we kind of know that's how Roy Hodgson's Crystal Palace have played this season. And that's how they've gone about winning their matches. And it was so pleasing to watch for the first hour just how dominant Brighton were, and that Crystal Palace literally didn't create a single chance in the first half. And it's just so annoying and irritating when you've had that much domination of a game and you haven't been able to get that second goal to just kind of kill the game off a bit. Because, you know, at 1-0, there's always that chance they're going to get an equaliser, and then they get the momentum and they can get back into it and potentially nick the game and win it despite not having any control over the game. Whereas if you just get it to 2-0 and you've got that cushion, it makes such a difference psychologically, I think, for the players on the pitch as well. And we just couldn't quite get there. And the most frustrating thing, and I know there are going to be some you get and some you don't with VAR, but for me, the Montoya penalty was, and I say penalty because I think it should have been a penalty.
If he's not offside, it's a pen.
Yeah, he wasn't offside.
There's no question.
Yeah.
There's no question.
Well, according to VAR, he wasn't offside, which is why the corner was then given and why the corner was taken by Brighton. If he was offside, then we wouldn't have got the corner. And that foul in the box is a penalty.
It's as clear as day.
It's a clear penalty, in my opinion, and in yours, Andy. And I don't understand why that's not been given. There's obviously this threshold that I have no idea what this threshold is, because it's completely subjective. And if we're meant to be looking at VAR for clear and obvious errors, that is one for me.
Well,
that's a penalty.
I thought that was the whole point of VAR, that it's meant to remove subjectivity from certain decisions.
But it's not done that at all, because there is subjectivity in quite a lot of the discrepancies when it comes to VAR. And this was another one of them where clearly they didn't think that the threshold was high enough to overturn the referee on the pitch's decision. And it is what it is. You know, we're not going to completely grumble about this for the rest of the season. It's just one of those annoying moments, because for me, that should have been a penalty. And what it kind of made me think about is, as footballers, I don't know where they stand on how they're meant to react if they're fouled in the box. Because in my opinion, the way Montoya reacted, because he still tried to get his shot off.
Well, he did get his shot off. It was a good save, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it was a good save
for Brighton.
Because he's carried on despite being fouled, he's got his shot off, and then he hasn't really complained about it. He's not gone rolling around on the floor looking for a penalty. Nothing's been given.
But I wonder
whether that's got anything to do with why it wasn't given.
But that shouldn't make a difference when it comes to VAR, should it?
No, it shouldn't. But I feel like if Montoya made more of a meal of it and, you know, rolled around, complained, if they went over and, you know, went up to the referee and he made more of a meal of it, would the decision have been different? Obviously, in retrospect, we don't know. Mm. We have no idea what it would have been. But it's interesting to think about it that way, because we don't like seeing players do that. But then when they do it, they often get the decision.
It often looks like more of a dive when you try and stand up, though. And that's always been the way it's been, and that will be the way it continues to be, really. To take your mind off that, I've got a little email to throw in here from Jack Hammond. It says, "Hello, Jules and Andy. I used to be a Stretford End season ticket holder at Manchester United, and after the last two wins, I'm very happy with how United have done." I guess it's written before the Everton game. The main reason for my email, as I love the show, is to discuss everyone becoming a Brighton supporter for their second team, thanks
Amazing.
To Jules. My second team is wherever my favourite player, Chicharito, is playing, so it's Sevilla. But after Brighton's recent win over Arsenal, where they bossed the first half, played as a team and passed around like Real Madrid, I thought I would email in to say Brighton are now my current third team. This is like the Ballon d'Or, where
I
you get
this.
You get 1 point for being third team, three for the first and two for the second.
I need to be on commission from the club, surely. Or at least get some free tickets to some games, please.
Well, I'll tell you what, if everyone listening who's become a Brighton supporter would chip in a pound to the AFC Wimbledon ground fund, we might make up that 11 million in double quick time. There's a lot of you out there. Thanks, Jack, for that. I wanted to ask you as well on Brighton. That midfield is really, really good, isn't it? They seem to have found a proper balance there.
Proper?
What's that would be a proper balance. What's interesting, I think, when we're talking about the Potter effect, is the main players, of course, Maupay has been big, but the main core of players who are doing so well for them are players who were already there.
Mm.
And that says a lot for Potter's, not just
his coaching
management of the squad, but his coaching, exactly.
I think that, you know, we missed Dale Stevens last night. Obviously, he didn't play the match, but him and Davy Proper, since they've been playing together, they've formed a really, really strong partnership in Brighton's midfield, and it's really good to see. And this year it's kicked on even further, because last season they played really well together, but it's improved. And I think the one thing that Brighton fans looking on at the team would hope for is that we can get more goals out of our midfield, more goals out of Dale Stevens, more goals out of Davy Proper. And I feel like that has improved. You know, they're still not plenty of goals from them, but they've got a job to do in midfield, and they're doing it, and they're doing it really well. But what's also been added to that is we've got Aaron Moy in the team as well now. He has been so impressive, particularly the last 3-4 matches. He's been outstanding for us, and he had another really good game last night. A lot of fans are calling for January for him to be signed permanently. That's a deal that I think a lot of us fans would like to see done, because he's on loan from Huddersfield at the moment. And he seems to be really enjoying his football down at Brighton. I mean, he's got the Aussie connection with Matty Ryan in goal, and he just seems to be loving what's happening on the pitch. And the players do, to be fair, but he's really fit into this side well. And he just adds that strength and also that creativity that I think just adds another dimension to our squad.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy for us to look at footballers and, you know, going back to John Gregory talking about Stan Collymore all those years ago, I think it's easy to look at footballers and think, you know, they have a great life, they have an easy life, that they earn great money. Of course they do earn great money for doing something they love, but I think you do see that with Aaron Moy, the sense that the shackles are off a little bit, as you say, because however good a player you are, however nicely you're being paid, getting beaten week after week after week is a bloody miserable experience. And they're all such incredible competitors as well. I think that's sometimes missed, to actually get to the point of being a professional footballer, never mind being a Premier League footballer. You're not someone who's the best player in your school. You're more than that. You've been, you know, the best or one of the best players in your area. And it's a combination of talent and working like there's no tomorrow. And, you know, to have that competitive edge and then be put in a situation where, you know, people admire you, people respect what you're doing, but at the same time, you go home and, you know, you say to your family, oh yeah, we lost again today.
Yeah, there's nothing enjoyable about that, is there?
That's not fun.
No.
So I think not just the football, but the fact that he's in a sort of positive dynamic, he's in a team where, you know, they're competitive in the Premier League, you know, they can go and play at places like Palace and Arsenal and give those teams a good game. And that feeling, I think, that assuming that he's in it for the long haul at Brighton, that, yeah, I'll be in the Premier League again next year.
Yeah, definitely.
That's nice.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about a player playing in teams and you know, you're just not winning and how unenjoyable that is, I've got a lot of mates that play at non-league level, and I just know from speaking to them that no matter what level you play at, you want to be in a team that's playing good football and that's winning. And I don't think that changes whether you're in non-league, Sunday league, whether you play in the Championship or the Premier League. Whatever level you play at, you want to be in a team that plays good football and wins matches, because there's nothing more enjoyable than that. And, you know, we're absolutely blessed to have Aaron Moy at Brighton. I think he's been an amazing addition to the squad. I just hope that in January we can make that deal permanent, because that would be a brilliant, brilliant signing in January. And I don't know whether, you know, Graham Potter has any plans to strengthen in January with other players, but I think that's one deal that we would love to see being made done. And he's so instrumental to what Huddersfield were doing last year. They missed him so much. He was out injured for quite a while, wasn't he, last season? And that was probably a big part of why Huddersfield ended up where they were, because they really did miss him. And now that he's been in the side, I remember when we signed him, I was a bit like, I didn't see that one coming, if you know what I mean. You know, sometimes you know that there are certain players that your club are after. That's not one that I thought, oh yeah, like we should go for him. It's just not a signing that I was expecting. But my God, has he taken me by surprise and has just been so good for us, as I said, particularly the last few matches. And yeah, fingers crossed for January. That's one deal that we get over the line. And the draw against Palace last night puts us, you know, we're in a decent position in the table, 20 points, and we're not even halfway through the season yet. I think that's decent for us. I think it's unfortunate really that we haven't picked up more points, because we've, in terms of the performances and the level of performance, I think we've deserved more than 20 points this season. There are particular matches that I can pick out that I think we definitely deserve to come away with wins from. So to be where we are, it's, I think, a good position, but I think it could have been better. And the draw for Crystal Palace takes them above Arsenal into ninth. I mean, wow for Arsenal.
Well, I remember in the late 80s, early 90s, when Palace were in the top flight intermittently, they felt like, that we're talking about rivalries, they felt, a lot of their fans, as if they had a big rivalry with Arsenal. Now, Arsenal fans never saw it that way. Again, I think it was part of a lot of them being peeved about Ian Wright being signed by Arsenal,
by
George Graham at the time. But for those Palace fans who still feel that, well, it's a great week for them, isn't it? But anyway, roll on the weekend of Saturday, 29th of February. Yeah, you don't get those too often, do you? 29th of February. When Brighton pay Palace in the return. Maybe we'll get ourselves down there.
Yeah, we need to do that, because we tried our best, didn't we, to go last night to the game, but it was so impossible because there's such a small amount of away tickets, and I thought, I can't be going to the home end, can I?
No.
I wouldn't be able to sit on my hands. But now you've seen the way I am when I watch Crystal Palace against Brighton, there's no way I would have been able to sit in the home end at St Ernest Park, is there?
Does it feel like you scored more against Brighton than any other
time? No, it's got a really good record against us, and always scored against us, so it's always a bloody happy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
B You're listening to Jules and Andy on Football Ramble Daily. You can always get in touch with us at Jules Breach, at Andy Brassel, at Football Ramble on Twitter, or email julesandandy@footballrambledaily. So we wanted to have a bit of a chat about the way that football media could potentially be changing in the future and how we as viewers and football fans will end up consuming football in terms of TV in the future. And the reason we wanted to discuss this is because there's a brilliant article in The Athletic written by Adam Crafton. The subject of it is, with audiences falling and attention spans shortening, is it time for football to change? And he's talking about football changing in the sense of how broadcasters televise football. Now, I'm going to read you out a little bit of this so that you can see where we're going with it. So he says, during the 2018-19 season, the live match audience for Champions League football dropped from an average of 2 billion during the previous three-year cycle to 1.3 billion in the last campaign. In a single year, the Champions League experienced a traditional televised audience fall of 35%, and the Europa League also experienced a 17% drop. Now, he continues in the article and says, we now have a challenge. We're living in the age of choice, and gone are the days when the match on Saturday played in the local stadium is the main source of attraction. There are a plethora of platforms and markets to find, and we're in danger of losing fans if they're not captured at an early age. I find this really interesting because in the day and age that we live in now, where everyone consumes entertainment so differently, it's not just football, it's entertainment full stop, where we're always on our phones. I use my phone pretty much for everything. I use my phone like a mini laptop.
Yeah.
It's literally what I do everything on, other than when I'm
pay for stuff,
much,
plane tickets.
When I'm watching football on the telly, pretty much is one of the only things that I actually don't use my phone for. And sometimes I even use it for that if I'm out and about and, you know, wanna get my Sky Go on the app and watch a game while I'm out and about. But the way we consume media now is so different to even 5 years ago, Andy. And I wonder whether it will bring about a bit of a change in the way that broadcasters and other channels produce stuff.
I think the smartest channels and the smartest broadcasters have already started to respond to this. I mean, Adam says quite rightly, in a single year, therefore, the Champions League experienced a traditional television audience fall of 35%. But that's a traditional television audience. We're talking about people sitting down in front of their telly. And, you know, we've already had this experience to a certain degree. The fact that there is this disconnect between different age strata of the audience, haven't we? Because when you had 11 Sports coming in and having the Italian football and the Spanish football at the beginning last season, you know, you'd have people of a certain age complaining that, well, it's not on a proper channel. You know, we can only see it on the laptop, or we can only see it on the iPad. Personally, I find watching stuff on the iPad quite comfortable. I don't
mind it.
I don't find it significantly worse to watching on a television, for example.
I prefer it on the TV, but I'm happy to watch it on a laptop or an iPad.
Exactly, and you know what? I think there are ways around it for a bigger game. I think I mentioned to you a while back, for my son's birthday a couple of years ago, we bought like a cheap projector to have a movie night, and you just like plug the computer into it, put it on a white wall, and away you go. It's kind of like watching like a movie or football in this case in the pub. Yeah. Really, it's quite good, and it's a cheap solution. It's really, really easy solution. And so if there's a big game and we all want to watch it at home, we'll plug the computer into the projector and stick it on the wall. And you know, that's not like an elite choice. Like I said, we bought it for like 50 quid, and you know, it will last for ages because we only use it fairly infrequently. So I think that would be a different way of people doing it. If you get all your mates around to do that, you know, you can have this kind of like big match in the pub experience at far less cost to yourself. And I think that is the issue at the moment. That is the big issue when we're talking about changing habits of watching football on television, is the cost. Because at the moment, it's fragmented. And we spoke about this a few weeks ago, didn't we, with Sky, with BT, with Amazon, with Premier Sports. But I think as streaming capabilities become the equal of normal television, internet becomes more reliable, hopefully, God willing. Eventually, I think what's happening with Amazon, you will get to a point where if people can buy individual matches or people do have a greater choice, eventually the consumer will win. We're in a bit of a halfway house at the moment where if you want to watch everything, it's pretty horrendous and
you've
got to pay for everything. But I don't think that will last forever. The other thing as well, when we talk about that traditional television audience, like I said, the smarter companies, I think, have reacted to it as well. And you do look at BT, and, you know, of course, you work for BT every week. I work for BT now and then, so vested interest and all that. But the no filter UCL stuff has been a massive
Absolutely
hit.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And I know, you know, it's a totally different way of... They're not just trying to bring the match into your front room. They're trying to bring the whole experience into your front room, because that's what you always think of. I think if you take it right back to the beginning and you think of why did I love football in the first place, it's when you make that walk down to the ground. It's when you pass the smells of the food and, you know, the noises from the club shop and
the flags,
all that
and
sort of
all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And
the
knockoff shirts. That's what it's all about. That's what Italy does better than anywhere else. It really does. San Siro, that's the one. All of that, and they're able to bring that into your front room, because I think it's something that I thought of when we were making Out of the Match on Stakhanov. The fact that you've got to realise that we're lucky. We get to go to all these places. We get to go to all these stadiums as part of our work. But there's a lot of people out there who, for geographical reasons, for financial reasons, they're not able to do that. So I think to understand that the experience is not just what happens on the pitch in those 90 minutes, that is so much more. And it's something that the Bundesliga has talked about quite a lot, because they would see one of their key tenets as the atmosphere, as the match day experience. So how do you bring that to people in other countries who aren't able to go? It's something that we talked about BT, something that Bleacher Report have worked on quite well in the States. And, you know, they get pundits from different perspectives. They got Steve Nash, the former NBA MVP. He's been involved and a massive football fan. He comes from a British family, so he's been massively into football since he was a kid and growing up in Canada and all the rest of it, even though he succeeded in basketball. So I think there are these companies who realise that now it is consumed in a completely different way, and there's people are smart. The consumer's not just a passive consumer. You know, they're not just sat there on their sofa and the football's happening.
They're, in the background,
they're happy to like pick up their phone or pick up their iPad and search stuff out, whether that be a favorite player or a favorite team or whatever. Because, you know, another thing that Adam focuses on in his article is the fact that there's a feeling that more people are interested in following individual players. It's a bit like what Jack said about following Chicharito, for example, mm-hmm. before in his email, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And in Adam's article as well, one of the things he points out is that in terms of that traditional consumption of football media, i.e. watching it on the telly, we've kind of moved on from that a bit now, where that's not all we want. Or if you miss it, there are other ways where you can obtain watching it, like you've mentioned, with No Filter that BT Sport do, which obviously goes online. I think that in Adam's article, he points out that, for example, the Manchester Derby got a couple million, however many it was, views on the TV. But within the space of a week, the amount of views that a highlights video that was, say, 3 minutes long on YouTube or whatever, wherever it was online, got triple the amount of viewers in the space of less than a week. And I think that is definitely a way that the way we consume football is changing. And Optus Sport, who are the Australian rights holders of the Premier League and the Champions League, who I work for regularly, I think the way that they've kind of formatted their business is absolutely brilliant, because they've catered to every different type of football fan. So if you don't know who Optus Sport are, they're essentially like the equivalent of BT Sport, but in Australia. But they've got the full Premier League rights and the full Champions League rights. So everything gets shown on their channel. They are a traditional TV channel, but they are also an app. And on their app, what they have for each match that gets shown, so they'll show the match live on the telly and they'll have the live replay of the game on the app. But then they'll also have a mini match on there as well, which will be, say, 20 minutes long, for example.
Okay.
And then they'll also have a highlights package, which is 3 minutes long, which will essentially just be the goals and the best chances. Whereas
BT do something similar.
Yeah, very similar
don't
to
they?
That. Very similar. And so in following that model, what they've found is that a lot of people are watching the mini matches, which are the kind of 20-minute long ones. So they want, maybe they don't necessarily have the time to watch the full match, but they want more than just the highlights. So then yeah. they watch, say, the 20-minute upload. And it could be potentially due to the time difference, the time that the football's on in Australia is the middle of the night. So maybe for them, they prefer to consume that just that kind of 20-minute package. But I do think that that's really interesting and that's a different way that people are now watching football, because I'm sure they, you know, they probably have the figures on what how many watch each video. But I think as a football fan, like I would want to watch Crystal Palace against Brighton in full because that's my team playing.
Yes.
But actually, maybe with some of the other games from the weekend, I'd be happy to just watch a 20-minute highlights video, if that makes sense.
I'd take less for Wimbledon if I've lost.
But it is...
minute and a half would be fine. Thanks.
It's one of those things. And yeah, I do think that the more that we kind of carry on in this, you know, modern day age where everything we do is online and, you know, we're consuming a lot on tablets and our phones, having those kind of quicker videos to watch is more what it kind of keeps us up to date with this sort of fast paced lifestyle, doesn't it? Also with the recent Amazon service that was offered in December, and obviously there's Boxing Day games coming up on Amazon as well. I was slightly worried that with Amazon streaming every game live, that it would affect the attendances in the stadiums. And one of the things that I was actually really pleased to see is that it didn't at all, really. From the games that I saw, I was actually at Selhurst Park for the Crystal Palace Bournemouth game on the first night of Amazon's 3 days worth of streaming just before Black Friday. And yeah, I didn't notice that there was any difference in attendance. It seemed pretty full at Selhurst Park to me. So I was quite pleased to see that. And hopefully it'll be the same on Boxing Day. And the good thing is that because of the 3 o'clock blackout that we have in the UK, it's never going to be a case where every single game will be streamed live on TV. So
not for the foreseeable.
For the foreseeable. So, I mean, hopefully it doesn't affect attendances, but I can't see... I feel like when it comes to broadcasting football, you can't change it too much because as viewers, the simpler the better when it comes to football, surely.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. I know it'd be interesting to see how it works. And as you say, full stadiums are absolutely integral because just as people will say football needs TV, TV needs the stands to be full. It looks terrible if the stands aren't full. And you need that feeling of the very best matches in the very fullest stadiums or the biggest occasions in the fullest stadiums. You need that feeling of the noise like leaping out of the television at you, don't you? It's very special.
Yeah, and I remember when I went to the Napoli-Liverpool game, the first game in the group stages of the Champions League, and you'll know better than me, Andy, because that was my first visit there, that they don't allow any fans in the bottom tier. So
it looks empty when there's 40,000 people in there.
It looks empty on the TV. And I had like my mates messaging me and I was tweeting saying like, oh, it's absolute brilliant atmosphere. And it was amazing. Like, it was absolutely brilliant. I thought it was a really good atmosphere in the stadium. And then they were all messaging me going, what? Like, there's no one there. What are you on about? And it was like, that's obviously not translating through the TV screens because you can't see the fans, which is crazy because obviously you could hear them, but because you just can't see them, people just assumed that there was no one there.
It's funny because the thing that I used to love so much about watching football on TV when I first watching TV, there's nothing better than seeing a team attacking their home end and scoring up it.
Yeah.
Because you can see all the people going crazy behind the back of the stadium. And funnily enough, the thing that works so well for Italy and that I remember from watching Italian football as a kid, I used to get these videos of Serie A from a shop called Soccer Scene on Carnaby Street in London. This was before Serie A was on Channel 4. And the thing that I used to love in the days of Maradona and Careca and Van Basten and Hullet and Aldo Serena, I used to love the fact that when they scored, because you had these massive running tracks around the Italian stadiums, how they'd all go off on this, like, you know, mini tour of the stadium almost after they score. They'd go off, Maradona would get buried under 20 ball boys and the subs. And the fact that people really wigged out, it was absolutely brilliant. But what really worked for Italian football then, because you wouldn't have been able to do that without the running track, doesn't work now. Because the fact is that it's not just, because the Premier League and its viewing experience and the intensity of it, and part of that is the fact that the stands are so close to the pitch, that has become almost best practice all over the world. You know, you looked at last weekend when Real Sociedad played Barcelona, they've totally changed that ground. The Anoeta, it used to have a running track around it, and they've gradually, like, brought the stands in and got rid of it. And it's made an enormous difference to the vibe in the stadium. So I think the desire all over the world is to have that feeling of closeness and intensity. And I think that's just as important when you watch it on television as it is when you're in the stadium. We've got a bit of correspondence, some of it linking back to last week. And you've been very generous in getting in touch with you, getting in touch with us and sharing your thoughts, as always. I wanted to read a few of them out. There's one here from Samuel Dixon here saying, "Hi, Jules and Andy. As a Wimbledon fan, the last few weeks have been a pretty torrid time," you're telling me, "with the proposal of a potential sale of 30% of the club. I was wondering your thoughts on what the situation is and your hopes for the future of Wimbledon and Plough Lane." We'll come back to that in a minute, but there's a topic as well that Samuel talks about, which quite a few of you have touched on. Also wanted to comment on a major topic of discussion on the most recent episode. I think the Rainbow Laces campaign has been a pretty decent success so far, but recent events have shown that there's a huge way to go. It was only a few years ago that I was bullied off my secondary school team as a result of my sexuality, and that kind of behaviour feels like a constant in the Terrace and ramps up whenever these campaigns come about each year. He also says he really loves the podcast. Well, thanks, Samuel. There's one from Ali White as well, who starts with "G'day," even though he's from New Zealand.
Ah.
He recently visited the UK and attended the Brighton Pride Parade. It's safe to say it was one of the highlights of my 6-month trip. The people, the colours, the atmosphere was incredible. I'm a massive gooner and I don't get to see my Arsenal play live all that often. Usually I'm up at 3 a.m. to watch them on the telly. There you go, that global reach.
There you go, there we go.
I went with a friend from New Zealand who'd been living in the UK for a few years. We wanted to take a photo, so I held my phone out to get a selfie, and a few guys behind us jeered and asked if we were from Brighton and made other homophobic remarks. The remarks weren't aggressive, and I'm not sure they were even meant in jest, but even this casual homophobia has no place in football. And I think this is a huge reason we don't have any out footballers in the EPL. There's also one from Declan Lancaster that I wanted to get to. "Hello, Jules and Andy. I love your guys' show since it's been a refreshing take on a wonderful sport. I just wanted to comment on your guys' refreshing discussion on LGBT players in men's football. It's sad to hear that both of you know players who are gay and are uncomfortable to come out, even though 2020 is just around the corner. Coming from a working class background in the northwest of England, I, however, would also not be comfortable with coming out if I was an LGBT player in professional football. I feel as though it's not the individual player's responsibility, but that of top flight leagues to realise modern points of view."
Who is that last one from?
From Declan.
Declan, thanks for your email. Thanks everyone for getting in touch. Obviously, we do try and have as many discussions as we can on what we consider really important subjects. And I think that they've all made some really good points there, haven't they, Andy? Because, you know, it's what we discussed last week, that, you know, we personally know people that are, you know, in football that aren't comfortable coming out. And it's really sad to hear that. But at the same time, I think you made a really good point last week, didn't you, Andy, about, you know, they shouldn't feel like they have to, because it's up to them if they want to come out or not. They shouldn't feel like they have to be this kind of trailblazer.
That's what Declan says, isn't it? I mean, it's their life. It's not, you know, it's not a soap opera, is it?
Yeah.
You know, people have right to their actual lives, don't they?
Exactly. Well, keep getting in touch with us, Jules and Andy, at footballrambledaily.com if you want to send us in an email. We'll be back next week for the last episode before Christmas.
And you'll have calmed down by then, won't you?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm fine now. I'm over it. We've got Sheffield United to look forward to at the weekend.
You see, I'm not even going to go back to Samuel's point about the current AFC Wimbledon funding crisis, because I don't think we can have two of us on the edge in the studio at the same time. Rest assured, Samuel, I'll come back to it. We haven't heard the last of this story. Work in progress.
Join me and Jonathan Wilson every Saturday on Football Ramble Daily for new episodes of Greatest Games in association with the Blizzard magazine. The Best of the Blizzard is available now. A perfect Christmas gift? I think so. 23 of our favourite pieces from the first 5 years of the Blizzard for you, friends and loved ones. Everything from Socrates and Scotland to St. Pauli and football smoking culture. Head to the shop now to buy the Best of the Blizzard at theblizzard.co.uk.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.